presented by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Playbook co-author Ryan Lizza. It's Tuesday, May 7th. Here's what's driving the day. The air seems to be deflating from Marjorie Taylor Greene's threat to oust Speaker Mike Johnson. The Georgia Congresswoman met with Johnson for 2 hours yesterday, and after that meeting, she was tight-lipped about whether she would go forward with the motion to vacate, which, of course, she previously said she would trigger this week.
She'll be back in the Speaker's office today at 12:30 to continue the talks, and we've got some exclusive details in this morning's playbook on what concessions she's hoping to secure. For one, she wants an end to Ukraine funding. Two, a return to the Hastert rule, where no legislation is brought to the floor without support from a majority of Republicans. And three, the defunding of the special counsel probes into Donald Trump. Some of these will be easier for Johnson to agree to than others, but remember that Green's leverage here is limited because most Republicans are opposed to removing Johnson, and Democrats say they will have his back too.
Donald Trump is back in court this morning after an extraordinary day in the Manhattan hush money case, where two big things happened. One, Judge Juan Merchan warned Trump that if he violated the gag order in the case one more time, that Trump would face jail time. Merchan didn't specify how much jail time, but there are reports that the Secret Service and the Department of Corrections in New York have been in discussion about arrangements for Trump should he be incarcerated for criminal contempt. That news overshadowed two major pieces of evidence introduced in the trial yesterday: the handwritten notes of two top Trump Organization executives that clearly showed they were not paying Michael Cohen for a legal retainer, which you'll recall is central to the prosecution's fraudulent records case. What the testimony yesterday didn't explicitly show, that Trump knew the details of this accounting cover-up. Prosecutors also said yesterday that they have about two more weeks of witnesses left. There are a number of developments in the Middle East that we're watching this morning, including Israel's response to a Hamas ceasefire proposal and the beginning of an Israeli offensive in Rafah that threatens to cause a major split between President Biden and Bibi Netanyahu. And joining me now to discuss those developments is national security reporter Alex Ward. Good morning, Alex.
Morning, Ryan. How are you?
Good. So let's start with this ceasefire, which was a breaking news event yesterday, but then seemed to be less than meets the eye. What happened?
There is a ceasefire, which is one proposed by Egypt and Qatar, which, as based on some reports, seems to be softer, quote unquote, than what Israel wanted. And then there is a deal that the U.S. supports and that Israel has already agreed to, which is, I guess, the ceasefire, but that is not what Hamas agreed to. So you have the Israelis saying, okay, well, this might be the basis of a negotiation. Hamas is clearly agreeing to something. Let's kind of hash this out. Now the question here is, you know, did Hamas do this because they, you know, the U.S. has been criticizing Hamas for not agreeing to this deal yet and going, actually, we've agreed to a deal. Now it's in Israel's court. Also, there had been rumblings for a bit that Israel was planning an invasion of Rafah fairly soon. Maybe this was a last-ditch effort to stave it off. Who knows? It could also be that neither Netanyahu nor Hamas really want a deal here for various reasons.
And Alex, do we even know what the difference between the two deals is?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the Israelis want the hostages to be released every 3 days. The Egypt-Qatar proposal is every week over the 6 weeks, and I think it's like three every week. And so it would lead to basically by week six, which would be the end of the ceasefire, then there'd be 15 hostages left, and then they would be released at the end. And so this would be a way to get Israel to abide by it. And then also, there's some reporting that this Egypt-Qatar proposal includes what Hamas wants, which is Israel eventually withdrawing all of its troops from Gaza, which seems unlikely.
I guess the final thing is the fact that Israel did not outright reject this. You said that each side has reasons that they don't actually want to have a deal. But the fact that they didn't outright reject it and they said they're going to consider it and they said they're going to send mediators to go talk about it, how do you interpret that?
Well, I mean, the negotiations have been going for a long time. And look, let's be clear. Initially, the Israelis were saying, look, Hamas agreed to something that we didn't agree to. And then there were some other reports, well, this is close enough that maybe this is a bargaining position. So yeah. You're right. This isn't like it was sort of rejected first and then moved toward. But, you know, the CIA director, Bill Burns, is in the region. He's the one really, you know, hashing out a lot of these details. I think it's very possible that maybe in the next couple of days, the sides move closer, make something happen. But it's not like either side sort of went, OK, we're done here. However, the fact that Israel dropped bombs on Rafah, you know, within hours of Hamas coming out and saying we are agreeing to some sort of ceasefire might complicate discussions.
All right. Good segue to what's going on in Rafah. Is this the long planned attack on Rafah? Is it something short of that? And how is President Biden going to respond to this?
So we should remember that Hamas did launch an attack on Israeli troops on Sunday, and it killed 4 Israeli troops and injured another 10. And so the part of Rafah that the Israeli military has asked to be evacuated is eastern Rafah, the area where that attack was launched. So those 100,000 Gazans have been asked to move to Al Marawi, towards the west. And that is the part of Rafah that the Israelis have attacked. And on Monday, the IDF spokesperson, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, said that they hit 50 targets. So you ask, okay, well, that's 100,000 or so of 1.1, 1.2 million Palestinians in Rafah being asked to, you know, ordered evacuated. You've got the attacks. You know, is this the beginning of it? And it's like, yes and no, I think is the answer. No, in the sense that I don't think you're not going to see a massive Israeli invasion sort of in the immediate days ahead. But yes, in the sense that when I've talked to IDF troops and they, you know, on the record, a spokesperson said, well, this is the quote unquote preparation for the eventual invasion of Rafah. And this is the way the Israelis are saying it. This is part of the way to move civilians out of harm's way. So it's unlikely that these 100,000 ordered removed are, you know, going to come back home. To be ordered out again before an invasion is going to start. So this is a sort of a small step towards that military operation, but who knows when that comes. In terms of the Biden administration, you had National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby yesterday tell reporters from the White House briefing room, you know, that the administration opposes any operation in Rafah, quote unquote, in general, end quote, if it were to put civilians at risk. So that, you know, it's not just, there's always been this question of, well, maybe the administration opposes a major operation, but not a smaller one. Well, this is Kirby and on behalf of Team Biden saying, well, it's really any military operation where civilians are in harm's way. So really what he's saying is, as long as there are, you know, innocent civilians at risk that could be killed in such a military operation, the administration opposes it. Now, that's a pretty maximalist position. This puts Biden in a bit of a bind. While he has been pushing the Israelis very hard to care about the humanitarian issue and the plight of Palestinians, he has been less willing to use any leverage he might have, namely restrictions on arms transfers, to push the Israelis towards a different military path. And so now here he is, you know, looking at the Israelis, see what they're starting to do in Rafah, and who knows if he's actually going to condition aid or anything else, but this poses quite the challenge for him.
Alex, thanks so much for breaking that all down.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And for your schedule today, the Senate and the House are in. And this morning, President Biden will deliver the keynote address at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's annual Days of Remembrance ceremony. This afternoon, Biden will host President Klaus Iohannis of Romania for a meeting. I'm Ryan Lizza. Thanks for listening.
A new study reports credit card rewards provide a lifeline for working-class Americans. Rewards like cashback empower low-income families to pay for everyday essentials. So why are DC politicians partnering with corporate megastores to end your hard-earned rewards? The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill takes billions from American families, lining corporate pockets instead. Tell DC politicians to oppose Durbin-Marshall. Learn more at electronicpaymentscoalition.com.